Support for the Media Project comes from the College of St. Rose, Albany, New York, offering a master's degree in communications with classes in online journalism, digital video production, interviewing, and crisis communications. strose.edu/grad.
And Rosenbaum Media Group, a digital communications agency integrating high-definition video into PR, marketing, advertising, and social media campaigns. Big-picture thinking for local and national clients. RosenbaumMedia.com. From Northeast Public Radio, this is The Media Project, a weekly discussion about issues confronting the media.
Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They know the lowdown, now it can be told. I'll tell you quite reliably off the record about some charming people I have known. For I meet politicians and grafters by the score. Killers plain and fancy, it's really quite a bore. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They wallow in corruption, crime and gore. Ting-a-ling-ling, city desk, pull the press, extra, extra, read all about it. It's a mess, meets the test. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. It's wonderful to represent the press.
This would be The Media Project. We are here in the studios at WAMC in Albany, New York, with Dr. Shartok, Dr. Alan Shartok, the iron-fisted but golden-throated ruler of Northeast Public Radio's empire. How about that?
I think that's all true. So what you're implying is I'm something like the ruler of North Korea.
Kim Un Shartok. Rosemary Armeo is here, investigative journalist, professor at UAlbany. Wonderful to see you. Where have you just come back from?
Jordan. The Arab Investigative Reporting Conference. It was very moving, yes. These are people who really are risking their lives. They don't make any money. It's hard to do the work, and they're still trying to tell people about what's going on.
And the government and the Jordanian press is
not very good. We have it much better here. Mm-hmm. And while we were there, even worse, one of our Azerbaijan colleagues was arrested and put into jail for 2 months, pre-trial detention, they call it. That's even before you go to jail, you go to jail. And the charge against her was instigation to suicide. Apparently, she would not help someone get a job, and that person's now charged her with drove me to suicide. And the government's looking at this and could put her in jail for 7 years.
Oh, my God.
Her real crime, of course, is she's been writing about corruption in the first family.
Yeah.
So,
you know, raises a question that I think we can address here about when you talk about how different it is for us.
Oh, yeah.
I should introduce myself. I'm Rex Smith, editor of the Times Union. I got my colleagues introduced here and failed to note that, just in case you want to write letters and protest my description of Dr. Shartok or something. You know,
you look very nifty in your nice little sweater.
You're very kind. And that does go to the question, Rosemary, of the questions about what it is that could yield to a reporter actually being locked up in the United States. There have been those circumstances.
I found it interesting. There was a big wave to get my Azeri colleague out of jail, and American press institutions and politicians have called for help for her. And the government has been responded by saying, United States, look at your own record, which is pretty interesting, you know, that we may not go after reporters all the time, although the government has subpoenaed their records, listened in on their phone conversations. We have really, the Obama administration has been quite bad about going after leaks to reporters. It has the same effect. And the government is pointing out, saying the state has an interest in what comes out in the press, and we're going to go after people we don't like, just like you do.
Which is interesting.
I think that's a bit of an exaggeration.
Well, of course it is, and they're doing it because of
But the idea that you led somebody to suicide because you wouldn't give them a job is the pretext. That's pretty flimsy.
Yeah. I know. Oh, yeah, it's definitely. And then, you know, they put her in jail. Her name is Khadija Islamayev. She's an amazing reporter. And they put her into jail and then sent 30 investigators into her apartment, which is not a big apartment. So we're all worried that you know, they were putting things in there so it could lead to
something
worse.
That's what you always worry about.
Absolutely.
It's so inspiring when you think of what these people are doing. I was at a fancy dinner in Washington a couple of weeks ago where a reporter from Nigeria was being honored for investigative reporting in Nigeria that really exposes the corruption of corporations there, right, which are closely tied to the government. And it is really at great risk to herself and to her colleagues.
Yeah, they do.
To their life. She is
a martyr. She's really put herself and her family at risk, knows she does it. And I also have to applaud my colleagues around the world. They began organizing at this conference in Jordan, and they're going to continue doing all the work she's working on. Everything she's working on, every company that may be connected to the First Family in every place in the world, the United States, the Czech Republic, Serbia, are all being examined by other investigative reporters right now.
Interesting approach, isn't it?
Yep.
You know, that instead of just complaining, they're putting a little heat on and saying, okay, if you do this, this is what we're going to do.
So the opposite of shutting down the reporter, shutting her up, is that they've now magnetized her effect, and people all over the world are continuing what she worked on.
And when you get to a place like that, Rosemary, what's your role?
Well, I wish I had a bigger one. I'm helping to spread the word. I'm sort of doing that right
here,
although I had not planned to do it. Yeah. We organize campaigns to get people working. I have some people looking at records in the United States to see if there's any connection with any of the firms or people that were in her stories to United States concerns.
Well, and you
so
teach,
we'll
but this is what you teach
these
folks to do, which is you're giving them techniques for getting to the bottom of things.
Oh, yeah, and that's how to look at records, how to interview people, how to make connections like this that hadn't been made in the past. So it's really easy for despotic governments to hide their bad deeds. It's a little less easier now when journalists look over their shoulder.
You know, part of what journalism education has to be in this country, in addition to teaching people how to find things, how to write things, how to do things, is really the teaching the ethic of it, is teaching people the values that underlie journalism so that this kind of tradition of standing up for this kind of work will be transmitted from one generation to the next, so that it won't be lost when we don't have the organizations, the legacy news media that have been underlying a lot of it.
Well, as you know, Rex and Rosemary, I have this little Legislative Gazette project, and I teach them, you know, a seminar once a week. And the first thing I always say to them is, don't let anybody push you around. Because they will try, including, I hate to say this, other reporters who say, well, you're just young, you know, you shut up. You've got to have that fire in the belly, and you got to know what you're doing. But if a legislator says to you, I don't take calls from you guys or from the Legislative Gazette, you've got to stand up, you've got to tell them off.
I also want to point out that this whole effort to take over Khadija's work and carry it even further comes from a U.S. effort. Back in 1974, Don Bowles, a reporter in Arizona, was killed, blown up in his car in the middle of the day. He was looking into organized crime holdings in Arizona, and led by the legendary Bob Green. Rex, you know him well from
Worked
Newsday.
Worked for him very closely, yep.
Some 45 reporters and students and other journalists just descended on Phoenix and put out the Arizona Project, which was what he was working on, only in a massively expanded form. So rather than being shut up, Don Bowles' effect was magnified. And now we're trying to do the same thing on a global level. That's pretty awesome.
It's a great idea. Hey, we like to let our listeners in. So here's a letter. This is from Kate in Wappingers Falls, who says, I was listening to your broadcast and wanted to make a comment about the dropping need for news websites since everything is searchable. That is, we were saying that through both search and through social media, that's how information is getting distributed rather than people going to websites by brand, the way people used to buy a newspaper by brand.
Interesting.
She says, I understand the point. However, for me and most of my 30-something-year-old peers, I like knowing where my news is coming from. I want to know that this article has the backing of the New York Times or the Times Union or the BBC. Sure. In a time of crowdsourced news, I really want to know that the article that I'm reading was properly vetted with sources and comments from all the parties involved. I appreciate journalistic integrity and intelligence. I love this woman. Wow.
Yeah. it's like you wrote that.
Hey, great work,
Kate.
Or
somebody you know.
She says, with the internet, we do have the choice to get our news from anyone. I want to know that the news information I'm getting is from credible sources. Many in my generation are becoming more interested in quality over hype. Would that were true, Kate. I can only hope that the news media continues to provide credible places to go for news and makes clear what is journalistic reporting and what is opinion stating. Both things are important, but absolutely not the same thing.
Great letter.
How about that?
Great letter. I have to tell you guys, And Rex, get ready with the self-serving horn.
Okay. I'm ready. Okay.
Last week, I wrote my column. It's, you know, in a number of papers. It starts in this Legislative Gazette, right?
That was the self-serving.
And, right. No, that's fair. That's very fair. I would do it to you. And it was on fracking. And I talked about the governor and his approach to fracking. And I reminded everybody about what Pete Seeger said about the governor and fracking. And if you take their money, you'll go down as the worst governor. And then I proceeded to talk about the new Pew poll, which shows that Democrats are going increasingly against fracking. Those are the Democrats in his family, in the governor's family. And then I proceeded to talk about other issues having to do with clean water and the rest. Well, I don't know what happened, but this thing has been retweeted thousands of times. I mean, thousands of times. I never had anything like that happen before to a column. But you know what happened, I think, is that the anti-fracking community got a hold of this thing, and they just went to town.
How about
amazing.
That?
It makes one's stature even greater.
It can be a wonderful thing. Yeah. It really spreads your reach far beyond what a local publication would ordinarily be. Or far
several
beyond
local
what this
publications.
Would. Absolutely.
Which I point out that I'm not in the Albany Times Union, but I am in things like the Troy Record, the Plattsburgh, the Kingston, you know. papers of note like that. I'm not laughing at them. Sort of passing a message over here.
Is that true? I can't imagine. If you'd like to pass a message, we are media@wamc.org. That's how you send us a message, as that wonderful piece from Kate in Wappingers Falls did. So, you know, that's a good thing, right?
Right.
Talk about trying to limit what the press can do. A judge in Connecticut recently ordered the Connecticut Law Tribune not to publish an article. Now, that kind of prior restraint is almost never found in the American media. He sealed the order, that is his own order, and other documents, and then a week later he vacated the order, and he kept it under seal nonetheless. And, you know, it's then he unsealed everything. It's really confusing, which is what happens when a judge gets sort of, how do you say that, out over beyond his reach or something like that?
Or get stupid.
Because
this is the kind of thing that you don't let the genie out of the bottle. You know, I mean, once it's out, people are going to know that this is there. Probably would do worse than if he had not sealed it in the first place.
There is some concern by people watching this, certainly by the people writing the article that we're looking at, that the judge was not aware that there might be a First Amendment problem with this.
Oh, boy.
He is, as judges ought to be, quite aware of the constitutional protection for a fair trial, and he's concerned that juvenile courts are generally closed to public purview, but completely forgot the First Amendment. And then when informed about it, like, no, you can't stop publication, he pulled back on the order, but in no way changed his reasoning on why he wanted that order in place. Mm-hmm. So it's pretty a pretty nasty thing that went on.
If I say a judge is stupid, can I be held in contempt of court?
I don't think so, unless you say it. If you're a lawyer speaking to the judge, you could
be. Yeah, you could be, yeah.
But you're here in the radio, I don't think so.
I think the First Amendment covers you, if he ever read the First Amendment.
Well, that's the problem.
That's right, exactly. And if you say it about a particular judge, he could be held in contempt of radio. I mean, I think he is contempt.
Well, contemptuous radio.
Contempt, absolutely. Last week, we talked some about the Rolling Stone fiasco, the story about the University of Virginia rape story.
And we called it early here.
We did. We were. It was fairly early for this. What happened was Rolling Stone wrote a story about an alleged gang rape at UVA based upon a single source, based upon the victim talking to the reporter. Now there have been significant questions raised about whether that account is accurate. It just goes to this bigger question of how you go about reporting some of these difficult issues. It is understandable if you're reporting rape that you wouldn't necessarily go to the perpetrator,
accused rapers,
right?
Yeah.
Whom the
No, that's not understandable.
That is their point.
I think the media has brought this on herself. We insist on treating rape like some sort of special crime. It's not. It's a horrible, violent crime that we ought to cover rigorously. That includes the victim's names and all the circumstances that went on. Of course some people lie. They lie in all kinds of crimes. Why should they not lie in rape? And we're acting like it's something different. We brought this on ourselves.
So this is why we wanted to do this, because last week we said, if Rosemary were here, she would be making this point. And so now Rosemary's here making this point.
She is. And you know, the old game of Saluji, Well, Saluggi is where two guys are throwing a ball and there's somebody in the middle who's supposed to try to get the ball, monkey in the middle, and it keeps getting closer and closer. So the magazine is now in terrible trouble because they can't make it right. They just can't figure out how to make this right. I mean, they had to apologize.
They didn't do the work ahead of time. Yeah. And they put out an apology. The apology is messed up. It's just, and it's done such harm, not just to the magazine, not just to the woman, Jackie, involved in it, but to women who want something done about rape and sexual assault on campus. Senator Gillibrand in our own state is dealing with this now. She wants to get through some decent legislation on handling these situations. And she's hampered now by this view that this magazine has really helped, that women lie, so we don't need any more extra protection. It's just really a mess.
Well, Rosemary, just for the sake of playing devil's advocate for a minute.
Well,
don't women sometimes lie?
They do, absolutely. I am the mother of sons. I will never, never take a clear view on rape. It is a horrible crime, and we need to cover it as we do other horrible crimes. That means you talk to both sides, you find out what happened as best you can, and you tell the whole story. That did not happen here.
Now, by contrast, the New York Times did a remarkable story earlier this year by Walt Bogdanich, long-term veteran investigative reporter.
Double Pulitzer Prize winner.
Absolutely. And his piece spotlighted a case at Hobart and William Smith Colleges in upstate New York. Her name was not used, but her identity was not hidden. But what they did was, it was a thoughtful, deep piece in which he did talk to all the sides involved, talk to all the administrators, talk to everybody. That kind of depth of reporting is not exactly what we saw in the Rolling Stone article.
I would even go this far. I would say they didn't have to print what the rapist, with the alleged assaulters, yeah, whatever. I don't even know what to call them in this situation. They didn't even have to print that side, but they didn't even bother to listen to it. If you're going to talk about journalism ethics, it begins and ends with this. You listen to everybody's side, and they didn't do that.
But let me ask you both this question. The New York Times is the New York Times. I mean, New York Times walks into Hobart and starts to ask questions. People say, "Oh, the New York Times." But the Rolling Stone article, am I wrong, was written by an individual.
She's a pretty well known and well credentialed freelancer.
And
there's,
Rolling Stone has done some very good reporting. It's not that Rolling Stone is just rock magazine from the 60s.
That's its past. It has done some remarkable investigative reporting.
Good. Now you guys have said what you should say in terms of covering your butts. But when somebody's a freelancer, the question then becomes, what's the relationship when they bring a story to a magazine? What has to happen in a case like that? And is the relationship different than if it were at the Times Union or the New York Times?
I have some experience with, some unhappy experience with freelancers hired to do serious reporting, and it's why I really almost never do it. And every time I say, no, we don't hire freelancers to do investigative reporting, when I make exceptions, I have generally been burned. I'm really sorry
to
say that.
That's bad to hear.
So if somebody shows up in your office, either of your offices, and says, I've got something so hot it will blow your socks off, and gives you, that's the come on. It's very hard to say no, isn't it?
You then hook that person up with a reporter. You could have that person shadow. You could have it shared byline by a freelancer and a reporter. Or you could hire if you want to talk about a freelancer, Rosemary is an experienced investigative journalist and editor. So you could be a freelancer for some place. You can sell. So you hire that kind of a freelancer. When you're describing freelancer, you're thinking of, you're probably just not imagining somebody with the kind of background that a Rosemary would have, for example.
That's a little bit weaselly, Rex. What I'm talking about here is that somebody, you guys have already said, this is a fairly well-known freelance reporter who brought this here. There's a big difference still between the relationship between the editor of a major paper and hiring on a freelancer. And you, by your own words, and I admire them, Mr. Rex, say you've been burned as a result of taking these chances.
All these stories are really risky. That's one thing you have to know. I mean, there's people say just print the truth. Everyone has a different idea of what the truth is. And as a reporter, what this reporter had to do was to go through all of it. I mean, don't
it's
you
Rashomon.
Wonder? Yeah, don't you exactly? It is. Don't you wonder what really happened? Everyone sort of agrees something happened to that young woman. UVA and many, many students at that school believe that. Wow, that could have happened. We need to take this seriously.
Sure.
That needs to be looked at. Even though the story is wrong, there's something about it that's true. It would have been such a service to cut through all the discrepancies and the incomplete information and to have gotten the real story. Rolling Stone did a disservice in just putting out a story that was so half-baked that now it'll never come unsorted, I think.
I think it's probably true, and the challenge now at UVA is for the administration not to just drop the ball, not to say, well, this individual account seems to be flawed and therefore, phew, let's go on and have a
not.
Football game.
Yeah.
Apparently
yeah.
they're not. They did suspend the Greeks.
Mm-hmm.
I mean the Greek fraternities, we
right.
should say. All Greeks.
Nobody from Greece has been suspended from school.
And they have not pulled back on that.
Mm-hmm.
Yet.
Mm-hmm. Yet. Excellent. But to Rosemary's point, it does underscore the importance of multilateral sourcing, of talking about, so not only it's not yeah, just
sure.
the person who was accused, but also the friends, the other authorities, in this case.
And the circumstances. I mean, in other words, let's leave the University of Virginia, because I don't want to talk about that, because, you know, I don't know anything about it. But let's just say somebody is really drunk and says, okay, I'm going to take everybody on.
Under the definition thing. Passed
the
now
one.
In the State
yeah.
University of New York, that is
rape,
constitute
yeah.
that is sexual assault. Absolutely.
Okay, I want to bring up one other thing on this story, and that's basic editing. Everybody's sort of defending the fact-checking. The lawyers thought this was all true. When I read the story, it was at the stage where it was out. It had gotten a huge reaction, and then slowly editorials were being written saying, this doesn't feel right to me.
Mm.
And women's groups, of which I am a member, were saying, oh, isn't this awful? You know, the men want to try to deny it. So I read the story, maybe with a really skeptical eye, and the first thing I thought of is the description where the woman describes being thrown down on a glass table and it shatters, and then her attackers are on top of her. And all I could think of was, don't they have cut up knees? There must be blood everywhere.
Right.
And that is never addressed in the story. How can that be?
That's amazing. That's interesting.
Yep. So I just think there's some careful editing that was not done because they were so ready to believe that woman.
Because yep. of philosophical approach.
Right. Yeah. It's what is that called? Confirmation bias.
Uh-huh.
You think gang rape goes on, and so therefore a story about gang rape seems believable to you. But there's something, you don't have multiple sexual couplings of whatever sort in a field that's littered with glass shards. It just made no sense to me.
Okay. Another topic that's important in the current that's been big in the news, and that is, of course, demonstrations in the aftermath of the decisions involving Eric Garner and the decision in Ferguson,
sure.
Missouri, and so on. Memo from NPR to staff warning NPR staffers in Washington not to participate in the National March Against Police Violence, a protest that was organized in response to those cases.
We've talked about this here.
What do you think about that, Alan?
Well, we've talked about this. In our case, we certainly have the same rule at this radio station. And we have had at least one really bad experience years ago in which one of our reporters joined the line. And we said, absolutely not. And we said in the future, that's a firing offense if you do that. You cannot do it. You can't join that. Now, somebody's going to say, well, but that's their civil liberty. You have no right to tell them that they can't do that. Well, we have objective standards, which we have to adhere to, and the perception of objective standards. Rosemary is looking at me, and I know she'll have something to say about this.
Go right ahead.
I think if an NPR staffer took this to the Supreme Court, they'd win the case. The First Amendment mm-hmm. rights are being violated. And I used to believe that, okay, I'm going to give up some rights to be a journalist and I have to be objective. But I don't think that way anymore. I think that reporters should vote. I think they should march. And I think you can cover police and still be against unwanted police violence. How is that a conflict of interest?
It's perceived as that if you're you can cover police and be against police violence. I think police are against police violence.
Correct. There were police in these marches.
Yeah. But it is perceived by the police you're covering as taking a side against them. And
they already don't think that we're on their side. this is like saying, let's hide the CIA report on torture because it'll make Muslims mad at us.
You may be right, Rosemary, that if you were to take this to the Supreme Court, you might, NPR staff might be able to win. But I'm going to try to defend the regulation or the limitation even so.
Two to one. I'm with you, and I hate being with you.
I know. It's a terrible problem. We didn't get to some of the other issues that we've got.
I am happy to be a professor now because I can say what I think, which, you know, I have been doing a little bit today.
Absolutely.
Oh, indeed you have, and that's why we love you.
I can't imagine that you restrained yourself terribly much during your journalistic
career.
I
did. I had to obey these silly rules you guys put in place like this one.
All right.
Yes, and by the way, there are people in the academy who would do the same thing to you.
Well, there are. She fortunately has tenure at this point, so nananananer.
I love tenure.
That's it, folks.
If tenure was ever written for anybody, it was written for Rose.
Come back again next week and join us for The Media Project.
I'll tell you quite reliably off the record about some charming people I have known. For I meet politicians and grafters by the score, killers plain and fancy.